You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 24th of July, 2012, here on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand. Hello and welcome to Midori House here on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Tyler Brulé. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, as Spain's financial situation worsens with borrowing costs rising, we ask if things will get worse before they get better. And as China's plans to build a further 82 airports by 2015, we discuss the implications of having an airport on your doorstep and ask if so many are needed. And also we'll be looking at the latest situation in Syria.
I think in part this is a war of attrition. If you can't defeat an insurgency after 4 months, 8 months, a year, then the task becomes much more difficult.
And we also have Gwen Robinson from the FT's Bangkok Bureau in studio here in London. Gwen, tell us, you're just back recently from a trip to Burma or Myanmar. What are the headlines?
That's right. We're all calling it Myanmar these days. Big US business has discovered Myanmar, it would seem, with a flood of executives last week in Yangon and Naypyidaw.
Great. Well, we'll be talking to you in about 12 minutes' time. And we'll also hear how luxury brands are cutting their prices to break into the Indian market. Are these strategies damaging companies? All that, plus we have our second Olympic roundtable, and we'll play some pretty good music too, all coming up in the next hour right here on Midori House on Monocle 24. And good evening from a very sunny Midori House here in the heart of London. In Studio One, not so sunny in Studio One, but nevertheless, it is time to jump over to the news with James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. Syrian troops backed by helicopter gunships have been fighting rebels trying to seize central Aleppo. After a week of battles between President Bashar al-Assad's forces and his opponents in Damascus, fighting intensified in Aleppo, the country's commercial center. Rebels seeking to capture the center of the city were combating Syrian troops and intelligence men at the gates of the Old City, a UN World Heritage Site. Witnesses reported seeing the army bombarding several quarters with artillery and mortars as helicopters flew overhead. Israeli defense officials have said that the Syrian government is still in full control of its chemical weapons stockpiles in an apparent bid to calm fears that a non-conventional conflict could be looming. David Friedman, an expert on chemical and biological weapons in the Middle East, has warned that if Hezbollah would get a hold of the arsenal, it would be a great challenge for Israel.
I have the feeling that Assad will not use it against enemies. On the other hand, I'm more pessimistic about the possibility that these munitions and weapons will fall into the hands of the Hezbollah. This case will really be a great challenge for Israel and the US and the EU.
Ghana's president John Atta Mills has died, according to a statement sent by the president's office. The statement said the 68-year-old president died a few hours after being taken ill. No further details have been given. The credit ratings agency Moody's has warned Germany that its AAA rating is under threat. Luxembourg and the Netherlands, the Eurozone's other two top-rated countries, have also had their economies put on negative outlook. Moody's said the three countries were at risk from wider problems in the Eurozone and the possibility of Greece leaving the Euro. Moody's outlook on the economy for the Netherlands has left the Dutch with mixed feelings.
I think it's not good for the Netherlands compared also to the other countries that also received a negative statement. So, we'll see what happens. I don't think we can continue much longer.
I think it's not definitely bad for Dutch economy, but just the rules have changed.
It is only a forecast and most people don't know that. And I think therefore that it could be damaging, but I hope that the Dutch consumer and therefore the Dutch economy will not listen to that.
A further 1,200 British troops who've been put on standby will be called in to work on security at the Olympic Games. Ministers say they're leaving nothing to chance. The extra troops are on top of the 3,500 servicemen and women brought into the operation earlier this month when the private security contractor G4S admitted it hadn't recruited or trained enough staff. And those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
If Thanks very much for that, James. It is just 5:05 in the morning if you are listening in Auckland, 1:05 in Taipei, 18:05 here in London, just after lunchtime, 1:05 if you are in New York, 13:05, I should say. We are going to go away for a short break. We're back in a moment.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Hongkongist, Tokyoist. Sie sind Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Вы слушаете Monocle 24.
Λόντος τεκασίν, τέμα ον Monocle 24.
Λόντον μπορ, έζα Monocle 24.
Λόντζαδά, μπορέσε Monocle 24.
Λόντενιστ, σύνο Monocle 24.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
O que você está ouvindo é Monocle 24.
Isso é o Monocle 24.
Você ouve Monocle 24.
Isso é Monocle 24.
Você está ouvindo Monocle 24.
Você ouve Monocle 24.
Você está ouvindo Monocle 24.
Isso é Monocle 24.
Isso é Monocle 24.
Em Monocle 24, how about you?
And you're back with Midori House here in Studio One, live in London. Well, it's only Tuesday, and this week Spain's fiscal woes took a turn for the worse. Madrid's problems came in the form of Spain's 17 semi-autonomous regions, including Catalonia and Valencia, who are in deep debt and looking for a slice of Spain's 18 billion euro public fund. Meanwhile, the rating agency Moody's warned that Spain might well be in need of a full bailout, which has in turn put pressure on the euro's more robust economies. Indeed, even Germany's economy is feeling the effects of Spain's monetary turmoil. Moody's is reviewing the status of Germany's AAA credit rating to negative, which could be the first step towards a possible downgrade. As Germany's finance minister Wolfgang Schäuble meets the Spanish economy minister Luis de Guindos in Berlin this evening, yields on the Spanish government's benchmark 10-year bond reach euro-era highs. And we're joined now on the line by Miles Johnson, the FT's correspondent in Madrid. Hello, Miles.
Hello.
What is the bigger of the headaches, I guess, when you have a whole gaggle of semi-autonomous regions also coming with cap in hand?
Well, the problem really is at the moment is that these are semi-autonomous regions, which some of them are actually sort of in quite a complicated political situation themselves, in the sense that sort of with Catalonia, there is this debate over, you know, increasing debate in Catalonia over whether, you know, they want independence on their own. And now we're seeing a situation where regions are having to go to the central government to request, you know, aid in almost a sort of Russian doll style sort of intervention, where Spain gets intervened by Brussels and then other regions in Spain get intervened by Madrid with harsh conditions imposed.
I was talking to someone from Barcelona yesterday, and it was just interesting speaking to someone from the business community, and said that, you know, we're looking at something which, you know, may not be sort of, you know, a 5-year situation, but, you know, maybe even a decade situation. He was really talking about people who work in finance. He said, you know, on one side you have, you know, many small to medium sized enterprises which are doing just fine, but he said if you look at so many other corners of the country at the moment, he said just, you know, really no jobs there. And he said, you know, not quite generational, but he said, you know, you could really be looking at sort of, you know, a decade of people, you know, with really nowhere to go. And I'm wondering, from a correspondent's point of view, what is the mood on the street in Madrid and elsewhere when you travel around the country?
I think the mood on the street in Madrid and indeed elsewhere in the country is increasingly one of anger. You know, before there was a sense of resignation, there was a sense that these were austerity cuts which had to be made, that sacrifices had to be made by a sort of wide cross-section of Spanish society. And I think that now has changed with the most recent package we saw approved last week by the Rajoy government, the 65 billion over 2.5 years. That's now hit the sort of section of Spanish society which hadn't felt as much pain before. So these are sort of your rank and file, you know, public sector workers who are now getting their pay cut and are now actually on the streets every day since the measures were announced, protesting. You know, this is now 13 consecutive days of protest. So I think there is now this sort of, this is a sort of fear and a sort of anger which we're seeing.
Miles, you also see it in terms of just everyday cuts, and whether it's, you know, very obvious things like rubbish collection, fewer ambulances on the street to respond, or are some, you know, are some essential services just that they remain essential and intact, or is pretty much, you know, every corner at a municipal and also federal level, you know, been hit?
Well, I mean, I think in the situation in Spain, as we sort of mentioned earlier, you know, because of these 17 regions, it's quite complicated because often local services are run by the local governments or the regions, and the regions are in to differing degrees in control of their own finances. And so in certain regions, I mean, I was in Valencia not too long ago where there was a protest outside of a school because the school was unable to pay its electricity bills, which meant that the kids in the school didn't have light or heating for periods. And I mean, that's something on a local level in Valencia, which, you know, is an extreme case, but it shows it really depends from region to region. But I mean, in certain regions, there really has been quite a large degree of irresponsibility.
If you were perhaps a fly on the wall in Berlin this evening and the discussions between Wolfgang Schäuble and Luis de Guindos, what do you think, who's going to have the opening question in those rounds of talks?
Well, I mean, I think the dynamic there will be very interesting because there is now an increasing acceptance, it seems, both privately and publicly by the Spanish government that they have done all they can do. In the sense that, you know, they are almost being left to boil in the bond markets, you know, as the summer goes on. There's no sort of respite. And the only action now, in the view of some ministers, is that the European Central Bank sort of relents and begins to buy Spanish government debt in the market, something which it has not done for 19 weeks now. And I really think that will probably be top of the agenda. You know, they're remaining quite tight-lipped, both in Berlin and Madrid, about exactly what they'll be discussing. Officially, they're discussing the latest austerity package, but I think it would be very unlikely that this meeting would pass without this issue of the European Central Bank coming to Spain's rescue being raised.
Miles Johnson with the Financial Times in Madrid. Thank you very much for that. You're listening to Midori House. When we come back, we're going to continue our Financial Times theme. We've got Gwen Robinson from the FT's Bangkok Bureau. She'll be joining us in the studio after this.
At one of the world's busiest seaports, Laem Chabang, it's easy to see why Thailand is such a dynamic trading hub. With our entrepreneurial, multi-skilled workforce, we're busy making sure vital goods get to market on time, every time. It's this hands-on approach that's made us the globe's fifth largest container shipping nation. But it's not only goods we're exporting. Our pop music is a big hit too. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
It's that time of year when Monocle packs its trunks and its bikinis and heads to the beach to produce our summer resort newspaper, Monocle Mediterraneo. Our large format paper takes the temperature of the region from Liguria to Lebanon, Marseille to Mallorca.
In the affairs section, we head to gritty Marseille, even grittier Baalbek, and I had the rather arduous task of a road trip along the Adriatic.
In the business section this month, we start off in Libya to look at how small businesses are playing a big role in the country's recovery. We also have a special report on the boat builders of the Bosphorus as the Turkish luxury yacht industry finally comes of age. And as always, we'll be doing our annual roundup of Pitti Uomo in Florence to see the very best that the menswear industry has to offer.
In the culture section, because someone had to do it, we found the beach clubs that turned into nightclubs in Beirut, Turkey and Menorca. And we scanned the musical globe for the perfect summer playlist.
In the design section, we discover a modernist neighbourhood in Naples, a mid-century gem in Ibiza, and a cool stone creation on Mykonos.
And we head to Tuscany to find out where US soldiers unwind on Europe's only US military-controlled beach.
Monocle Mediterraneo is on newsstands now. It's the only beach companion you'll need this summer.
And welcome back to Midori House. It is just 18:14 in London. We're now going to shift our gaze to Southeast Asia, but we don't have to go quite that far. And oftentimes we go and talk to the Financial Times' Gwen Robinson, a frequent collaborator of ours. But we also have the good fortune that Gwen is actually in studio today. So Gwen, of course, we were talking to your colleague, Mr. Johnson, about the very, very sad state of affairs on the Iberian Peninsula. But you've just returned, as we were saying at the top of the show, you've been in Myanmar recently, which is... as cited many times, it is indeed land of opportunity. And you've been zipping out a little bit, not quite zipping, because I know it's not quite that easy yet anyway. But there's so much discussion. Everyone's sort of talking about, hotel rooms are chock-a-block. And, every time, you meet somebody, it seems that they've been out to check out some avenue of opportunity in the country. So does it feel like something of a gold rush when you're in Yangon, certainly?
Mm. Well, it's quite extraordinary. As you point out, it is one of the few feel-good stories in the world. So it's really quite exceptional being a journalist in this current age where you've got Middle East blowing up and Spain and Eurozone imploding. You go to Myanmar, it's kind of all go, go, go. That's not to say, I think there's a lot of problems beneath the surface, and we've seen violence blow up in Rakhine State and these refugees pouring out, being turned back by Bangladesh. So that's a dark, ugly little thing going on in the background, which I suspect may come out and hit them in the face. But right now, on the surface, it's all, good and it's all go. And last week, the most extraordinary group of big US executives, US executives of big companies, they were big too, most of them. you had big companies like GE, Caterpillar, a whole host of financial and industrial companies all coming in to look at opportunities. It looked extraordinary. Whoever would have thought that in a year ago, that you had the captains of US industry being led by, undersecretaries of state and commerce, etc. So that was quite an exceptional thing. The week before, I'd been there to interview President Thein Sein of Myanmar, which was quite an extraordinary experience as well. And he was very, upbeat, determined to lift the country out of poverty, etc. And this week, some people may have read, he's blitzing Bangkok and sort of trying to promote the ties between Myanmar and Thailand, which are actually far more enduring than these new relationships that Myanmar's forming very rapidly.
So he's gotten over his small, could we call it a tantrum that he had when Aung San
Suu Kyi?
The tanty that he had when Aung San Suu Kyi showed up for the World Economic Forum. And then he said he was going to come 24 hours later. He didn't. He didn't come the next week.
That's right. On again, off again, off again, and off again. it's odd. When you meet him, he's this understated little guy. He's astonishing in his sort of understated, meek, mild way. And according to his advisors all say, he's not fazed at all about this rock star status that Aung San Suu Kyi's developed and how she pipped him at the post in Bangkok. She blitzed Europe. She was, on the stage with U2 in Ireland, etc., Nobel Prize. But he's very mild-mannered about all this. And has said to his advisors, when the time is right, I'll do my thing. And he's in Bangkok doing his thing today.
Gwen, tell me, when you survey the faces in the lobbies of hotels and wherever else people are cutting deals and doing business and looking for opportunities, you mentioned many of the big blue chip American corporations, but are there just as many Japanese there? Are there just as many Chinese? Is everybody pouring in your opinion?
Yeah, absolutely. The point is, though, and what I think has been lost in the wash, you're absolutely right. It's chock-a-block of all kinds of nationalities. Let's just say, though, the Chinese have been in there for ages. But what's being lost is you look at what deals are being signed, and there aren't a hell of a lot of big deals being signed. There's a lot of little deals. And, much was made of Coca-Cola doing this deal to come into Myanmar. Well, frankly, that isn't a bottling deal. It's not manufacturing. It's not making the drink. At the first stage, it'll just be distribution. But at this point, it's still extraordinary that Myanmar and I think North Korea and about Cuba, I gather, are sort of about three countries left in the world where you don't see any signs for KFC, Coca-Cola, Starbucks, McDonald's, there's nothing there. So I think it'll be festooned with Coke signs soon.
Well, I wanted to bring that point up. Do you think that when you spoke to, when you spoke to the leadership, is there an understanding that this is almost a good thing, that of course they're going to have to let Western brands in, but you have a country which is architecturally intact in many ways. There are fantastic buildings. There's a really wonderful cultural legacy. They have the opportunity to really, almost start with a fresh slate, where it's too late for many of the neighbors, and you can go up and down sort of the region, and they don't have what Burma has. Cultural ministry, do they understand what they're sitting on right now?
Yeah, I think they actually do. There's been a huge stress on the redevelopment plans for Yangon that is including and really prioritising the preservation of old buildings. And there's a big trust, heritage trust underway that's trying to protect and also look for funds to restore it. So I think they're well aware of that. And I was really struck at various conferences and economic gatherings recently, various people, including the economist Joseph Stiglitz and others, have said, yes, you know, it's a bit sad for Myanmar to be trailing behind all its neighbours so badly that its GDP per capita is only about $700. I mean, Vietnam's more than that. But the advantage for Myanmar is that they are going to learn from the mistakes of all the other countries around. So they know not what to do. They have cited, officials have cited Cambodia, for example, as an example of what they felt was sort of badly managed.
Not the direction to go.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And one other thing, just before we go, a lot of people also talk about just the proficiency of English, that this is a huge trump card as well for Myanmar as well.
Yeah, you know, people keep saying this. I tell you.
You're not convinced yet.
I cover the country and I'm telling you, there is not much English spoken. You've got to remember, after the crackdowns of 88, the government just banned a lot of, broke up universities and schooling, and the English is not actually there. You know, maybe at the higher levels.
Right.
But, you know, you want your workers on the factory floor to be speaking English. I think you're going to have to train them yourself.
Yeah, it would be the same with upper echelons, you know, probably anywhere in that case.
Yeah.
Gwen Robinson from the Financial Times. Yes, you're off to Italy. Then we'll have you back at base. Hopefully,
Tyler, you're outing me here.
I know.
No,
anyway,
I'm working hard.
more to be discussed when we're off air in about 39 minutes.
Okay,
Gwen Robinson, thanks very much. We're going away to a short break. I'll be back after this.
The head at Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Добро пожаловать, Monocle 24.
Essa è Monocle 24.
Detta è Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 this.
This is Monocle 24.
Afton Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
@1822 at Midori House here in London, 1322 in Washington. Well, around the world, aviation infrastructure projects often seem to meet resistance or face delays due to planning rows and lengthy appeals processes. We only have to look west from here at Heathrow Airport. But one country where expansion continues unfettered, no surprises, China. On Friday, the director of the Civil Aviation Administration announced that his country will build 82 new airports and expand over 100 more in the next 3 years. By then, China will have 230 airports of serious scale, and it's estimated that 80% of the population will be within 100 kilometers of an airport. So what does all of this mean for the traveling public? Will we have airports going to nowhere? We're joined now on the line by Joanna Liu, managing consultant at Asia for Ascend Worldwide, who are aviation consultants. Hello, Joanna.
Hi, Taylor.
I mean, it's quite remarkable when you look at these numbers and, you know, as referencing in the intro in London, we're having this tussle back and forth about capacity at Heathrow, whether the government, you know, will make a proper about face and allow a third runway. There's, of course, you know, ongoing discussions now about the night ban at Frankfurt. And then, of course, we have China, where it seems that you can put up an airport wherever Beijing wants. I guess two things from the analysis side of Ascend, are we going to be looking at a number of white elephants, or is the market really going to be able to sustain this much civil aviation?
Exactly. China has a really ambitious plan in the airport investment side. Currently, China has 175 airports, but in next 5 years, it will be like 230. So it's around the investment of 425 billion RMB, which is around 42 pounds billion. So I personally believe, yes, China does need this kind of a airport investment, because China already has more than 120 cities with population over than 1 million. So the international travel demand has been restricted by the networks and capacity of the airports. But most of the international traffic still going through Shanghai, Beijing, and Guangzhou, these kind of the main hubs. For the domestic side, I think the West China is developing so fast, especially in the economy side, and some more new capacities needed in that part of in China. So I think it really a new dynamic market in this area.
Mm. Joanna, tell me, we've seen over the last few months announcements with some European carriers announcing going into Chongqing, Air France flying into Chengdu. How much of this is real regional competition on the part of these other players? So, you know, is it really a case of Chengdu going out trying to seduce airlines from Europe to open up? Or is this perhaps predictably coming from on high that Beijing has now said, okay, it's time for Chengdu and for Chongqing to step up to the market and of course, fill in and maybe not connect as many passengers as are going through Shanghai, Beijing and Guangzhou?
Actually, it's not only Chengdu. Chengdu is just one of the secondary airports which growing really fast. We say that the secondary airport, that's roughly around 8 to 20 million passengers per annum. So basically, these over 2,000 lots, I think it's in the last 7 years, the number of airports with these in the secondary level was rose from 20 to 31. So a lot improving over the last 10 years. So these kind of secondary airports are really aggressive in trying to introduce new routes to their regions. That's why they need new capacities, need new airlines into this area. So they really work hard with airlines together to trying to introduce the new routes. It's not only Chengdu, but Chongqing, Hangzhou, Xiamen, Changsha, Nanjing. Urumqi as well, yeah.
Joanna, just before we go, I'm curious as well. We've seen some not particularly good results from many Chinese carriers lately reporting not particularly good numbers. Is this just because you've got this explosive growth? Is this just down to perhaps not hedging appropriately when it comes to fuel prices, or what's that down to?
Sorry, can I repeat?
Sorry, just I was saying that we've seen a number of Chinese carriers reporting not particularly good results over the last few months. And I'm wondering, you know, it seems quite curious when you have this explosive growth in terms of air traffic. So I'm wondering, why have some of the Chinese airlines not been faring so well on the balance sheet?
They basically fail in their international operations due to their lack of their networks overseas and their selling strategies. So they kind of never make any money in their international routes. But on the domestic side, it's much better situation. So they're struggling very hard to find a way to improve their international operations.
Great. Joanna Liu from Ascend Aviation, which is, of course, the global aviation consultancy. Thank you very much for that. We are going to go away for a short break. We're back after this.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24,
This is Monocle 24. 24.
This is Monaco 24.
Monaco 24 ja Yorkshire.
Tämä on Monaco 24.
The proper Jalavet. Monaco 24.
Esto es Monaco 24.
After Monaco 24.
The head at Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
You're listening to Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24.
And you're back in Studio One here at Midori House with me, Tyler Blair. We're just coming up to the bottom of the hour. It's 8:29 and exactly 30 seconds. And that means in the next 30 minutes, we're going to be discussing luxury brands establishing themselves in developing markets. Yesterday, there was discussion about, of course, what's happening with Chinese brands coming to the UK. We're going to be looking at elsewhere in the world. And we're also going to be dissecting Olympic branding. But first, James Luckhurst is here at the bottom of the hour headlines.
Syrian troops backed by helicopter gunships have been fighting rebels trying to seize central Aleppo. After a week of battles between President Bashar al-Assad's forces and his opponents in Damascus, fighting intensified in Aleppo, the country's commercial centre. Rebels seeking to capture the downtown area were combating Syrian troops and intelligence men at the gates of the old city, a UN World Heritage site. Israeli defense officials have said that the Syrian government is still in full control of its chemical weapons stockpiles in an apparent bid to calm fears that a non-conventional conflict could be looming. David Friedman, an expert on chemical and biological weapons in the Middle East, had warned that if Hezbollah would get hold of the arsenal of chemical weapons, it would be a great challenge for Israel. Ghana's president, John Atta Mills, has died, according to a statement sent by the president's office. The statement said the 68-year-old president died a few hours after being taken ill. No further details were given. The credit ratings agency Moody's has warned Germany that its AAA rating is under threat. Luxembourg and the Netherlands, the Eurozone's other two top-rated countries, have also had their economies put on negative outlook. A further 1,200 British troops who'd been put on standby will be called in to work on security at the Olympic Games. Ministers say they're leaving nothing to chance. The extra troops are on top of the 3,500 servicemen and women brought into the operation earlier this month when the private security contractor G4S admitted it hadn't recruited or trained enough staff. Those are the headlines here at Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, James. You're listening to part two of Midori House with me, Tyler Brulé. Well, events in Syria have gathered a deadly pace in recent days, with many wondering if we are entering the end game for the Assad regime. Today comes news of prison revolts in the cities of Aleppo and Homs, with government forces apparently killing eight in Aleppo. A little earlier, our editor Andrew Tuck spoke to the editor of the foreign policy forum EA Worldview, Professor Scott Lucas from Birmingham University, to discuss the situation further. They started by talking about what is behind the prison revolts.
I think it's just a reflection of the instability in the country as opposed to being a political move. We had similar developments in Libya towards the end of the Gaddafi regime, where you had a number of prison uprisings. And then in Egypt, we in fact actually had prisoners being released by the Mubarak regime when it was in its final days. So I take it as serious incidents. As you mentioned, several deaths in Aleppo, at least two deaths in Homs last week. But I think it's not a political focus, let's say, of what's happening right now.
But as I was hinting at the introduction there, the pace of events just seems to be gathering every day. Do you feel that there's a sense of the regime being just stretched in too many directions, really, for it to hold on to power?
I think the regime is definitely stretched, and I think what we have right now are two stories that are intersected. One story that you talked about in your introduction are the fights in the cities of Damascus, the capital, and Aleppo, the largest city. And while the situation is quieter in Damascus after more than a week of fighting, today we've got the insurgents making more attacks in Aleppo, with latest reports that they're moving on the old city, which, of course, is the heart of Aleppo and therefore the heart of the regime's financial base. The second story, though, I think is just as important. And that is, while these events are going on in Aleppo and Damascus, the insurgents are making advances in other areas. There are a number of towns in Syrian Kurdistan that have fallen to Kurdish fighters, not the Free Syrian Army, but to Kurdish fighters. The Free Syrian Army itself has made advances in the northwest. They've captured several regime tanks in recent days. And I'm not sure the regime can counterattack effectively to take back that territory when they're having to fight for Aleppo and protect Damascus.
And what do you think has been the tipping point in recent days? Do you think it's the continuing number of defections from the top military brass, or do you think it's perhaps that the arms are being supplied by, we believe, the likes of Saudi Arabia and Qatar finally making a dent in the regime?
I think in part this is a war of attrition, in that if you can't defeat an insurgency after 4 months, 8 months, a year, and now what is going into the 17th month, then the task becomes much more difficult. The regime is stretched not only in terms of defections, but it has a large number of conscript troops who are just worn out. It has lost a great deal of equipment from attacks, and it's suffering from the economic squeeze put on by sanctions. At the same time, alongside this attrition, you're absolutely right. There are more arms and more logistical support, including quiet support from the U.S. and European governments, going to the insurgents. And that means that they can hold their own in the Northwest. We're not at the point of a Libya where you're going to see a direct intervention, such as a no-fly zone backed up by NATO airstrikes. But quietly, I think the U.S. and European governments, as well as the Turks, they're putting their money on the insurgents.
Now, what we've also seen is that these cities in Syria have had very different kind of reactions to the revolt and played out the kind of war in very different ways. So, for example, Latakia is much more associated with the Assads and with the Alawites, and there it seems to be much quieter. Aleppo was slower to join this insurgency. Are we going to see these kind of cities kind of almost breaking away as city-states, being, you know, taking very different courses over the coming months? Or do you think that actually everywhere will get swept up in this revolt in the end?
I think everywhere's caught up in the revolt. Let's start with that. But I do think you already are seeing the divide that you referred to. In parts of the Northeast, in much of the Northwest, and in portions of the South, this is now territory controlled by the opposition and by insurgents. Assad is not in control there. In some areas that you mentioned, such as on the coast, Latakia, Tartus, there's much more support for the regime. There's not really a threat at that point. But that then brings us, I think, back to Aleppo and to Damascus. If Aleppo was to fall to the insurgents, or even if it goes into protracted turmoil, I think the regime is done. I don't think it can survive economically, and I don't think it can survive politically. I think they realize that, which is why they're moving more troops into Aleppo. And I want to make one other point, which I think goes beyond just a civil war. The Free Syrian Army doesn't actually have to take Aleppo. They don't actually have to go in and hold territory for long periods of time. If they go in and hold territory for 24, 48 hours, 72 hours, they've made their statement. They can then retreat, wait a few weeks, and strike again. And like I said, that's the war of attrition that I think will be the downfall of the Assad regime rather than a sudden collapse as we saw in Egypt and in Egypt.
And that was Professor Scott Lucas from Birmingham University talking to our editor, Andrew Tuck, a little bit earlier on the briefing here on Monocle 24. You're listening to Midori House. We're back in a moment. And it's just 1:37 if you're listening in Singapore, 20:37 in Beirut, 18:37 here in London. And I've now summoned one of our editors down to studio. In fact, he came of his own accord. I'm joined by our business editor, Jonathan Openshaw, to discuss the strategy behind luxury brands establishing themselves in developing markets. Yesterday, Jonathan, we were talking about the Chinese brand, which has opened up on South Moulton Street, hoping to, you know, build a bit of an aura and probably pass that margin that goes with the aura back on to Chinese tourists who are coming to London. But you picked up on something today from the Times of India.
Yes. Well, so the story yesterday, I mean, that's kind of the reverse story. But obviously, we're much more familiar with covering those surging growth figures that we've seen in the likes of China, India, Brazil, those kind of double-figure growths that you see in Richemont and PPR. And we like to have a bit of a critical eye on those from time to time. So there was a story today in the Times of India, which is that luxury brands from, you know, the big houses, we're talking Chanel, we're talking Dior, we're talking Burberry, is that they've been forced to offer slashed rate discounts up to 40%, it's reported, as a kind of entry point into some of these markets, as a way to get these new buyers, the burgeoning middle classes, kind of biting. And then the idea is, as a long-term strategy, then they'll start buying full price. But it's an interesting one to see these really proud old fashion houses from Paris, from Milan, having to kind of change tactics, strategy, and being led by these, you know, what would have previously been seen as peripheral markets. And it gets you thinking, what's the long-term impact for these brands?
Absolutely.
What does luxury mean if it's being led in this way?
Well, we're joined on the line now for a further spin on this. Manfredi Rica is the managing director of Interbrand in Milan. Hello, Manfredi.
Good evening. Hi.
What do you make of this? Because I think, you know, probably if you visit the boardrooms of Richemont LVMH PPR, I think everyone wants all markets to largely at least behave the same way. I'm sure they want other markets to perform maybe better than others. But this type of discount strategy in India, does it slightly surprise you? Because I've been talking to some of the Italian companies, and many of them have been saying that, you know, India is not China, and everyone's been, you know, pegging a lot of hope on India, but it doesn't have, you know, all of these, you know, secondary cities which, you know, have populations of upwards of 10 million people. And so I'm wondering why this perhaps different tack in that market.
Well, I think it comes down to the understanding these luxury brands seem to have of the Indian customer, and especially the Indian customer they are after. Typically, the Indian customer is known as being quality-driven, known as being discerning, and typically a very well-traveled, well-learned customer too, who is going after quality and authenticity in these brands, which I think makes the discount strategy obviously a lucrative one in the short term, but does raise some questions in the longer term, especially in the markets where the understanding of quality is there, but the heritage and the value of luxury brands, deep luxury brands, still needs to be diffused.
I mean, do you almost think it's a regional decision of local managing directors in that market who are saying, you know, obviously they're very keen because they probably want to open up stores in Kolkata and new branches in Chennai and elsewhere. So they want to, of course, make sure that when all the results get consolidated back at head office in Paris, that they look like their market is robust. I mean, you talk about it being short term, because I can't imagine, just as Jonathan was saying earlier, that, you know, so much is invested in maintaining the mystique of these brands that, you know, those kind of discounts at this time of year seem rather steep.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think when it comes to luxury, what may be risky is posing locally short-term objectives, which may be P&L objectives, which of course are part of the responsibility, but they should be harmonized with long-term brand building, local brand building impacts and results as well. I think it's quite controversial when we look at discount policies. I think there's a contradiction there, meaning that if the bet is that there is a relatively low price elasticity, then why lower price in the first place? If the belief is that there is a high price elasticity, then, I mean, you might have a problem in the long term. So it's a reasoning I don't completely buy into.
Jonathan, if you were a shareholder and you got wind of this as you're lying on your super yacht in the Med, would you be a little bit dismayed by this news?
Well, I think, I mean, it is. It shows a slight, this kind of eagerness to leap into new markets. It shows a slight disregard for the heritage and the history that's been. I mean, I think it's however lucrative the kind of the kind of riches that you can get from China and India look to be, there's still a real need within luxury to kind of be a brand guardian. And I think a lot of these kind of headlines, bargain basement luxury in India, if you can feel it feeding back into the kind of mother brand, and it can only do damage, really.
I mean, Manfred, you were talking also about, it sounds like also a very different consumer from many of the Chinese consumers. Of course, you know, we're seeing aircraft full of Chinese who are really sort of venturing out onto major Western shopping streets for the first time, and of course are buying up like crazy. But Indians have been traveling for a very long time, and very wealthy Indians have been out in the market. So do you think also maybe some of the luxury brands misjudge the market slightly, thinking that, you know, in fact, so many of these Indians are shopping abroad already, that they're actually not, they're not probably going to be patrons of the domestic branches?
Yeah, I agree with that completely. I think, again, if we look at what not just the size of the customer base you're after, but also its quality, then of course in India you're looking at people who've traveled a lot, have been traveling for a long time, and therefore this means that they understand quality and they're ready to pay all pair prices for things that they think are worthy of it. So I think not necessarily discount is going to be a good way to secure and make these customers loyal. You could look at different things to do. For instance, one way is to not lower price, but try to introduce different things like fragrances and accessories. That typically and historically has been a very smart way for luxury brands to have a kind of more accessible part of the offering while still maintaining the mystique when it comes to the core products. What could be done in terms of securing loyalty is also creating a specific customer journey for the high net worth individuals, which may, but not necessarily must, include private sales, which is a completely different way of interacting with customers and looking at securing the kind of customer base that can really create success in this market in the long term.
Manfredi Rica, Managing Director of Interbrand in Milan, thanks for that. Jonathan, just before we go, you were recently at Pitti in Milan. We have your full reportage in the current Monocle Mediterraneo just on newsstands. Do you see the Indian buyers out in force? I always think that's a great sign. You know, you know Japan is a big luxury goods economy because there's loads of Japanese buyers out there. You can sort of feel if the American market is improving because you see lots of Americans. Did you see a lot of buyers from Mumbai and elsewhere?
Absolutely not. I mean, Indian buyers are not a strong presence in the Italian market, certainly. You've got China rising, certainly. Hong Kong strong. Brazil huge this year. Brazil very big, and Turkey. But it's not a place where the Indians are not going to snap up independent Italian menswear.
You heard it here first. Jonathan Openshaw, business editor. We'll see you a bit later. You're listening to Midori House. When we come back, we're going to be talking about Olympic branding after this.
Thailand is the world's largest exporter of rice, shipping more grains abroad than any other nation. Perhaps even more surprisingly, we're also the world's leading producer of hard disk drives, powering global electronics. And we also make great music. So from sound bites to megabytes, you could say that we're making all the right noises. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
Almost 1847 here in London. You're listening to Midori House with Tyler Brulé. Next, we have our Olympic roundtable discussion on advertising, branding, and rather scary mascots. But first, let's hear something sunny from a Neapolitan band, Fitness Forever. This is L'Anarchia Pugliese. Little bit of Mediterranean Sun by L'Anarchica Pugliese by Fitness Forever. Now, it is just 2:49 in Tokyo, 20:49 if you're listening in Tallinn, and it's 18:49 here in London. Well, it's only 3 days to go until the launch of the London Olympics, a fact that is difficult to avoid here in the capital. You can sort of avoid it if you're in studio, almost. The advertising rules have angered many. Some find the Olympic mascots futuristic, one-eyed creatures creepy. One scared me in Regent's Park a bit earlier today. The London Olympics logo attracted widespread criticism when it was published and launched to the public 5 years ago. On the other hand, many consider the Summer Olympics to be the ultimate event for branding success stories. Well, I thought we would thrash this topic out. I'm joined by our design editor, Hugo McDonald, and also our creative director, Richard Spencer Powell. Now, we have images, gentlemen, of two characters who have become, unfortunately or fortunately, part of the landscape, the not particularly catchily named Mandeville and Wenlock. And Richard, I'm going to start with you. These are kind of liquid metal characters, and I'm sure probably many of our listeners have at this point seen these two beasts.
Yeah, beasts, I think, is the correct word. They're not particularly likable. I don't think they convey too much. I don't want to own one. I don't want one on a T-shirt or a mug. I'm not vehemently against the branding of the London Olympics. Like lots of my colleagues, when it first came out, I just thought, what a wasted opportunity. And I haven't come to love it, but I do think it's a lot more recognisable than some of the branding that's gone on previous Olympics. I mean, I can't remember what Athens looked like. I can't remember what Barcelona looked like. But actually, for the most part, lots of this branding that you get on these big Olympic occasions, it kind of looks like search engine logos or insurance companies. They're very, very bland and anonymous. And they never look like they've been done by a graphic designer. So I think these mascots are hellish. But I think probably in the end, they'll just... We won't see too much of them. Yeah. No.
I don't feel like I've seen very much of them at all.
Really?
I think compared to... I mean, the logo obviously is everywhere.
Yeah.
But Mandeville and Wenlock, I really haven't seen. Did you? Well, you bumped into one in Regent's Park.
Well, there's some in Regent's Park. And this is what I think is curious when you launch a pair of mascots, is that they need to be, of course... quite easy to execute. And I think because they're metallic, one is a titanium tone, the other one is more of sort of a chromey blue.
They're supposed to be steel, though, I think.
I guess they're supposed to be steel, but they had to sort of render them in different colours. But I think the problem is they're actually, that probably makes them, Rich, you would probably know better, probably quite expensive when you want to put them in life size. So what was curious in Regent's Park, one was red, one was just blue. So then they don't look like they're metal forms. They look like those sort of painted cows that you have, on streets, all over the world. So it's curious that you would think if you're going to go through a branding exercise like this, they should, be quite easy to roll out.
Yeah, I think it feels like... a bit disparate from the main corporate identity. I mean, the logo and its kind of Flintstones font has, as ugly as many people consider it, I think it's been rolled out quite well. It is very recognisable.
And when are you going to be using the Flintstones font in upcoming issues?
I think only if I work for a different company.
What's quite interesting, though, is... Wally Olins, who Wolf Olins designed the logo, said...
But he was gone by then, I think.
Well, he'd said when it was the huge furore that people would understand it 5 years from now when the Olympics came. And I, for one, hated it when it came out.
And do you understand now, though?
Well, I've learned to live with it it.
But I think, don't we learn to live with most logos in a way? You see a new aircraft, it doesn't mean that you're not going to get on that airline.
I don't hate it.
You don't hate it, okay.
No, I think actually it's a good point about we do get used to things that are bad, but I think for all those designers that complained about it, ask them to name two good logos. Mm. And of course they're going to mention Ottoleika, and some might mention Mexico 68.
Right.
But that I'm not so sure about. But other than that, they'll be stumped. And you can do the same with airlines. They might mention Lufthansa by Ottoleika. They might mention Swiss.
Mm-hmm.
Or American Airlines. But after that, you get into a big dirge of kind of corporate, anonymous, nonsense, really. So I don't think actually the 2012 is that bad in the grand scheme of things or in the history of it.
It's we have in front of us, of course, mascots from 72 right through to 2008. And I can definitely remember, I think the bear was called, Misha in the famously boycotted 1980 Olympics. I like him very much. I like him with his sort of his weightlifting belt that he has around its little tummy. The 1984 Los Angeles mascot, the American or Uncle Sam Eagle, with his rather large feet, is quite cute. But then, curiously, from two of the most recent games, I don't really remember that. And I know there was a big fuss about it. I think it was the echidna, which was the character for the Sydney Games. And no one even sort of knew what this animal was. I mean, even a lot of Australians. And I can't tell what the hell the character was for Athens.
It was supposed to be, it looks like a fetus, doesn't it? With awful swollen legs. But there was some overwrought symbolism. It's just like the ones that we have. Ourselves for the London Olympics, some big sort of ancient Greek happy stones that are supposed to appeal to children.
Mm. And then Beijing, I think Beijing had three characters, didn't they? And they all looked like they'd spent too much time around the blusher counter in a cheap department store.
Yeah, again, these things, they just feel like someone needs to shift some merchandise to pay for the games. And I think they're going about it the wrong way. These things look like melted waxworks.
Mm.
There's nothing in there. I don't see any children... asking mommy and daddy, please can have one of those.
No.
I quite like the beaver from Montreal, 1976.
Yeah, the wooden beaver.
Yes. Did you have one of those?
Well, curiously enough, my father worked for the 76 Olympic Committee.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm still paying it off. Anyway.
I think it took Montreal something like 30 plus years to pay for those games. But my family takes no responsibility for any of that. Do you, Rich, just going back also, just jump, I mean, it's curious. I don't remember 1996 Atlanta either, which looks like some mutant cousin of a Smurf in bad red Doc Martens.
Yeah.
don't recall that character at all.
No. I mean, but I think that's the thing. It's like, who does remember these things? And I think there's a lot of kind of guff that's been spoken these last few weeks about all these things in the about the Olympics.
Not in Studio One at Midori House, I'll tell you.
But I think in the end, the logo actually isn't that important. I think the architecture is more important because I think it's because it's such a global democratic event and it's just a televised event. My experience of the Olympics has always been the BBC's coverage.
Right.
And I never remember when Usain Bolt did that amazing 100-meter run 4 years ago, there being a mascot in the background.
Right.
Or where people's logos were, or what the Beijing logo was. I just remember what a great thing that was. And it, you know, it's still kind of clear in my memory. And I think that's the thing that people are kind of forgetting, probably because the event hasn't started yet.
So on the topic of the BBC, you know, title sequences and graphics, have you caught them yet?
No, I haven't actually.
They've got this thing called YouTube now, Rich.
Yeah, we've got this thing called Production Week, Tyler, which actually normally doesn't stop us.
No, I was going to say, yeah, Rich has kind of got sort of the automatic sort of shift for his screen to sort of magically transform. Anyway, you can go on to this thing called YouTube and you can check it out. But it is funny because it is the most... It's not even funny. It's a little bit sad because it's very much small, I think, East End animation house given big budget to do something experimental. And it's incredibly dark. I mean, you feel like they only probably started producing this, you know, 3 months ago when it was still incredibly rainy here. And it's not very optimistic.
It's brooding,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
And there's sort of thundery skies and
it's a bit Scottish, isn't it?
That's probably why I was quite moved by it.
Were you moved by
yeah,
it?
I was. We spoke briefly about why on earth they had to choose an animation studio to go with it rather than, you know, there's enough in this country to promote it with some good imagery.
Yeah,
good
I mean,
faces.
I thought you do want glistening calves and pecs, and I think you sort of want the sunniness and the optimism of the games. But anyway, we'll be tuning in because I think we are going to be having a rather large celebration and ceremony to, of course, cover the opening ceremonies come Friday night on our big jumbo screen drive-in that we have downstairs. Anyway, that's all the time we have for today. Today's show was produced by Dawn Trump. Our researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager was, it's Toby Hammond today. Thank you, Richard, and thank you very much, Hugo. Up next, after the news, it's this week's episode of Section D. It's your program, isn't it?
Don't miss it.
No, absolutely not. And today we're going to be hearing actually about the sports industry. And also in 3 hours' time at 2200, Ted Kravitz and Tamsin Smith are going to be here with the Monocle Daily. But it's going to be news time in about 1 minute and 5 seconds. Thanks very much from London. Have a good evening.